This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Bob Mann, professor of mass communication at Louisiana State University and a longtime politico, having been an aide to Governor Blanco and Senators John Breaux, Russell Long, and Bennett Johnston. We'll talk with Bob Mann about some politics and also hear his take about the state of higher education in Louisiana. His budgets have been cut and universities are complaining mightily. Also on the show, Rebecca Hamilton, the state librarian on the Louisiana Book Festival, taking place in Baton Rouge on Saturday, with more than 25,000 people expected to be on the streets and in the Capitol and in other places to salute the great authors of our state. And Sam Friedman, his book Breaking the Line, about Grambling football, which has become relevant in recent weeks. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. The outside of Baton Rouge number is 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In-house to begin the show is Bob Mann, LSU Mass Communication Professor, esteemed writer and former aide to Senators Russell Long and John Breaux, Bennett Johnston, also served with distinction in the Kathleen Blanco administration. Good morning, Bob.
Morning, Jim.
And a little later in the hour, we'll also hear from Rebecca Hamilton, the state librarian, about the book festival, which is tomorrow. And Bob, who has written how many books now?
Written or edited nine.
Nine books. Not bad for a man of 55 years. You will be there tomorrow, actually introducing one of your colleagues at LSU, right?
I will. Jinx Broussard, who is on the faculty at the Manship School, has published a really wonderful book with LSU Press. I edit a book series on media and public affairs, and she has written a fantastic new book about African-American foreign correspondence. It's really a great book. It's getting a lot of attention in those circles around the country.
Bob is also a columnist now with the New Orleans Times-Picayune and NOLA.com, and his latest work, I think, involves the money that colleges expend for athletics in Louisiana.
That's right.
Is that an issue?
Well, I think it is. I think, to me, it's not so much the amount of money, because even the amount of public funds is rather small compared to the overall budgets in higher education. But my point in the column was that we seem to spend a lot of time focusing on athletics on our college campuses. We care a lot more about the fate of the athletic department than we do the fate or the condition of most of the academic departments. And I just wish that people cared as much about what was going on in the history department or the English department as they cared about what was happening in the athletic department.
Well, the funding for universities is in peril right now from the state. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Sam Friedman about the Grambling situation, and the New York Times, in its editorial pages last Saturday, focused on funding or lack thereof for higher education in Louisiana, and noted that higher education has been cut significantly during the Jindal administration by about half. And it's not just Grambling, it's all over the state, and LSU has the biggest chunk, so by virtue of that, had the biggest cut. Has that affected the way things are going at LSU and at other universities?
It has. It clearly has. It means that people aren't being hired. People are leaving. Class sizes are larger. Classes aren't being offered, so students are having to spend more time at school to finish their degrees because the courses that they need aren't offered every semester. Maintenance is being deferred. You look at that New York Times article that ran last week or week before last on Grambling. I've been on the Grambling campus probably two or three dozen times, maybe more, over the last 30 years. It's been a while since I visited that campus, and I was struck by the pictures and the condition of the buildings on that campus. It looked like something you'd find in Haiti after the earthquake. It's deplorable how that university has been allowed to fall into disrepair. It's not quite as bad at other universities around the state, but you walk around the LSU campus and you look pretty closely, you're going to find a lot of buildings that are in pretty bad shape, need a lot of work. There's a lot of deferred maintenance around Louisiana on our college campuses.
Well, Governor Jindal has not accented higher education the way Governor Foster did. And Foster was the man who brought Jindal to the prom as the 24-year-old health secretary back in 1996. It's a difference in philosophy. And some folks who don't go to college, didn't go to LSU or Louisiana Tech or some other university in the state, they may not care. But it doesn't seem to have hurt him politically to this point.
I'm not so sure that's true. His public approval ratings are pretty low, in the mid-30s. In fact, by some estimations, Barack Obama is more popular. There was a poll recently that showed that if Hillary Clinton were the nominee of the Democratic Party and Jindal were the nominee of the Republican Party in 2016, that Hillary Clinton would beat Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. So I don't know. I don't know that we can make the direct causation between the budget cuts and Jindal's popularity or his sagging fortunes in the polls, but to say he hasn't suffered, I think, is not entirely true. Something's bringing his numbers down, and I would suspect it has something to do, maybe not everything, certainly not everything to do, but something to do with the way that he's slashed and burned the higher education budgets.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Slashed and burned. That's what Bob Mann uses as verbs to describe Governor Jindal's approach to higher education. Well, he's had two races in which he had nominal opposition. The most since he lost to Governor Blanco opposition he had was in 2007, and his opponents were Foster Campbell, John Georges, and Walter Blasso. I would imagine if we'd had Governor Campbell, we would have had a different approach on any number of fronts, and some might like it, some might not. But does a governor set the stage for this kind of thing? Is it really in the hands of the governor to determine where the money goes in the state budget?
Well, it clearly is. The legislature has to vote on these appropriations budgets, has to approve the state budget and all of that, but the governor in this state, perhaps as much or more so than any other state, sets the priorities. And the governor presents his budget. It's not the legislature that presents the budget. It's the governor that presents the budget in the spring. And that sets the stage for everything. Governor Jindal wanted to put more money into higher education. If he wanted to fund anything more than it is currently being funded, he and the legislature would find the money. And one example that I use, and I talked about it in my blog last week, was that recently the governor and the legislature decided to spend $1.8 million on creating a library for former Governor Mike Foster to house his papers from his eight years as governor. And so they found the money for that. Meanwhile, I pointed out that if you walk over to the Middleton Library on the LSU campus or any number of other libraries on the LSU campus or around the state, you're going to find them in pretty bad shape. And there is no other governor that's in the state's history that has had a library built for him or her to house the gubernatorial papers. Foster is the only one that has that. The Hill Library at LSU, the State Archives, the library at University of Louisiana Lafayette, all of them could easily handle those papers by Mike Foster. And so if it was a priority for Jindal to reward Mike Foster, his patron, with this $2 million library, and they found that money pretty easily, if they wanted to find $2 million to repair a library on the LSU campus, upgrade it a little bit, they could do that, but they won't because it's not a priority.
Well, yeah, it's a priority, and I'm sure it's a priority because Governor Foster is the person who is responsible for the creation of the political rise of Bobby Jindal, and some would say that's just politics, Bob. That's the way it goes.
Clearly it is politics, and it is the way it goes. But my point is that if your question was could the governor find the money to do what he wants to do, and that's one example of the governor easily finding almost $2 million to do something he wanted to do.
Well, to show you how politically charged this is, we had John Kennedy on the show a few days ago, and he's talking about doing away with these NGOs, which would be less than $2 million if he got rid of every one of them. And when I asked him about the Foster papers in Franklin, he said, well, you know, I'm okay with that. I'm paraphrasing him, but he too was close to Governor Foster.
Well, I don't think it's a good idea to do that. I think there are other existing libraries. I don't think it's a wise allocation of our resources. So, others, John and others may disagree, and there are plenty of other ways that we spend our money that are clearly greater than the $2 million that goes to this Mike Foster Library. My point is simply that if our leaders want to find the money to do something, they always find the money.
Mm-hmm.
And to say we can't afford to do this or that is not true. It's the what they're really saying is we don't make this a priority. It's not as important as this, that, and the other. And higher education clearly is not a priority in this state. It's just a fact. Higher education, the education of our college students in this state, is no longer a priority. If you go to the Grambling website, you'll find this really interesting mm-hmm. report talking about the budget cuts of the last few years. And Grambling, the leaders at Grambling say, we are no longer a state-supported university. We are a state-assisted university because they no longer get the majority of their funds from the state. The appropriations have been slashed, just as LSU just 5 years ago was getting 70% of its funding from state appropriations. Now it's 30%.
Okay. One listener says the Foster paper should be at Foster Hall at Louisiana State University. That'd be an appropriate place for them, wouldn't it? Right across the yard from the library.
Well, I think that's where they keep all the stuffed birds, but right across from Foster Hall is the Hill Memorial Library.
That is true.
Which is the special collections library and houses the papers of Senator Breaux, Johnston, Russell Long, Huey Long.
Right.
They could easily absorb those papers and would be happy to do so. And it might cost them a little more money to catalog them and organize them, but it certainly wouldn't be $2
million. $2 million. It's a lot of money. And, of course, the money could be raised privately, too. If you really want to do something like this, why does the state have to pick up the tab? For a guy who doesn't like taxpayer money being used for things, it would seem that the private sector could intervene. Perhaps Governor Foster could pay for it himself.
It'll be interesting to see how many people show up to that library once it's open to do research. Franklin is not the most accessible place in the world.
You've been to Franklin? It's a nice place.
I've been to Franklin many times, but it's not easy to get there. And if you're doing research, and most of the papers are in Baton Rouge at the State Archives or LSU mm-hmm. Library, it's not easy to get to Franklin. So, it doesn't strike me as very likely that place is going to be overrun with customers.
Jim on Highland, Jim, you're on the air with Bob Band. Good morning.
Number one, two questions, one brief. Bob, if you were being recruited today, would you even consider coming to LSU? And the second one is, based on the state's population and financial situation, we are so overburdened with four-year institutions. Shouldn't most of these be reduced to two-year and just have the right amount of three or four four-year institutions within the small state of it?
That's a very good question. Let me answer your second one first, and that is that I believe that's very true. We do have a misallocation of our resources in higher education in this state. You go to North Louisiana, within a 35-mile drive down Interstate 20, there are 3 4-year colleges.
Mm-hmm.
There's ULM in Monroe. There's Louisiana Tech in Ruston. And 5 miles to the west, there's Grambling. And another hour and a half down the road, there's LSUS. I think we could argue that we've got too much higher education and too much duplication of higher education in North Louisiana. We should probably consolidate. The political will there is probably not there to do it, but it would make a lot of sense to do that. And I don't think you would find a lot of people in South Louisiana complaining, but you'd find probably a lot of people in North Louisiana complaining, and those legislators are probably not going to do that. I'll answer the other.
Would you come to LSU?
Oh, absolutely. I love LSU and I love the students, and I wouldn't consider going anywhere else.
All right. 297 5633 is your number. We'll return with Bob Mann, fired up about slashing and burning, as he calls it, of the higher education budgets. We'll return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. Thank you for joining us today. 877-217-5757 is the long distance line, and Bob Mann is in the guest seat for a little while longer, LSU tenured professor of mass communication. Would you be vocalizing these sentiments so strongly if you did not have tenure?
I don't know. You know, that's a good question, and I might have to think twice. I've got two children to feed and a family to support, and I'm pretty sure that if I didn't have tenure, I wouldn't still be employed at this university. And my evidence for that is all the people who have been fired for speaking out in one way or another at LSU or run off.
Mike in New Iberia. Mike, good morning. You're on with Bob.
Yeah, Bob, in 1978, 1980, somewhere about there, I heard one of the most powerful politicians that ever lived in this state, from this state, make the statement that at that time, to close every university in the state and send all the children of the state to LSU on a full ticket, room, board, books, everything, and still come out ahead financially. Any truth, or was that hyperbole?
You know, I don't know. That would be a lot of students. You know, you'd be talking about over 100,000 students on the LSU campus, and I don't think anybody would want a school that large. That's just way too large for the kind of experience I think you'd want to give a student on a college campus. One of the reasons why I went to the University of Louisiana Monroe, ULM, then Northeast Louisiana University, was that it was a smaller school and it was more intimate, and I wasn't ready for a big campus, or at least at the time I was intimidated by a big campus like LSU, and I think a lot of students wouldn't come to LSU because it just is too intimidating for them, and it shouldn't be, but it is, and so I think they do deserve other options. I would hate to see it to be the only school in Louisiana. But do we need 5 or 6 journalism programs around the state? I'm not so sure. So I think that we could have schools specialize in certain fields of study, so that if in South Louisiana you want to study, you want to be a teacher, you go to this school. In North Louisiana, you go to that school. But not every school has the same program.
Casey in Central. Hi, Casey. You're on with Bob Mann.
Good morning. And I went to Louisiana Tech for pretty much the same reason. I wanted a smaller campus. An interesting idea has been used in a couple of other states making similar budgetary restraints in Louisiana, and it was simply to put a tax on a statewide ballot and let the people decide whether or not they wanted to give money to support higher education. And those states that have, most of them have agreed to pass that tax. Would you think that would be possible here in Louisiana?
Actually, I think that's a great idea. In fact, Representative Chris Broadwater, a Republican, serves on the Ways and Means Committee from Hammond, proposed something very similar to that in the legislative session last year. And he knew that it wasn't going to be something that would be immediately embraced, but he wanted to start the conversation. And so I think if you ask the voters of the state to pass a modest tax of some sort to support higher education, they would, because they support higher education. They don't want to see those budgets cut. But I also think you could argue that we have a misallocation of resources, that if we wanted to find the money to support higher education to a greater degree than we have, we could do that. These cuts are largely the result of a decision in Jindal's first year in office to cut income taxes for the wealthiest Louisianians at the cost of about $1 billion a year. And if he hadn't made that decision, we would have had the money over the last 5 or 6 years for funding higher education and health care.
Mark in Lafayette. Hi, Mark. You're on the air with Bob Mann.
Hi. Good morning. Mr. Mann, I agree with you that I think Bobby Jindal has been politically injured. I know that myself, as a former supporter, I did vote for him the first time. I did not like what he did in his first term, so he did not have my support the second time. And right now, I would not vote the man for homecoming king. I am interested to see if he try. If he has national ambitions, I think he'd be the laughingstock of the Republican Party, because I find him to be out of touch. I find him to be right of Ted Cruz, who are both completely wrong. And I can't wait for his term to finish, because I think it would only be an advantage to get someone else into the governor's mansion.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I find it interesting that some of the people who are most vociferous in their opposition to Jindal or his former supporters are Republicans who thought that he would govern in a way that he did not, and are very disappointed, almost betrayed by his leadership or his lack of leadership. And so I'm always interested to find that the people that I talk to who are the angriest at Jindal are often Republicans who once supported him. He clearly is running for president. He clearly wants to be president. And I think he and some other Republican governors make a good case that perhaps the next Republican president is going to be a governor, because a Republican nominee who comes from Congress is probably not going to have as good a shot as maybe a governor who's done some more innovative work. I don't think that person is Bobby Jindal, though.
Eileen in Oak Hills. Eileen, you're on WRKF with Robert Mann. Hi, Eileen.
Good morning. I have been particularly irked by this library for Governor Foster, and I did hear your program earlier in the week when John Kennedy was on, and I thought that was such a strange remark when he said that all of the governors should be entitled to one, because then that would be fair. And it almost seems like this is a minor point when I have so many things I could complain about with Jindal, but this is sort of like the cherry on the ice cream. It's such a waste, and I wondered if anything can be done to stop this, and if you would be willing to mount a campaign. I know many people who are disturbed by this.
All right. Thank you, Eileen. I think she's asking you if you're going to mount the campaign, Bob.
Well, I'm going to keep talking about it, and I've already written about it and may do so again, because I have a pretty high regard for John Kennedy and the work that he's done recently. I don't agree with him that every governor ought to have his or her own library. And I think all the other I think Buddy Romer and Kathleen Blanco and Edwin Edwards would disagree with him that they're not asking for their own library. Kathleen Blanco was happy to give her papers to the state archives and didn't ask for that and doesn't expect that. And I don't think that is a wise expenditure of our state money when we have so many universities that have special collection libraries with qualified archivists who could handle these papers in a very professional manner.
I could tell John Kennedy really doesn't support this library. He supports Mike Foster. He's a friend and he admires the man, and he's put in a tough spot on this. He may very well come out and say, look, it's stupid, but at this point, he's on the record, as Eileen said, as every governor should have one. Yeah, well, let's spend $2 million in Crowley and in Bossier City. Let's go down the list. Lafayette.
I think Jonesboro needs a Jimmy Davis library.
How about Winfield?
Winfield. Winfield has the political
history. By the way, have you been inducted yet?
In February.
In February. Oh, yes. Okay. Bob Mann will be in the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame. He'll be in there with Mike Foster. And who knows, maybe we'll have the man paper somewhere.
Right. Well, I don't expect $2 million, but $1 million maybe.
Well, what if John Bro called you and asked for a favor that you might not agree with, but you admire the man, you think he did a lot for the state, and your governor man and Senator Bro says, you know, Bob, I'd like to have a center for my legacy and my family and what we did for the state. What would you say?
Well, you know, I would say, have you seen our budget lately? First of all, I don't think Senator Bro, and I know him very, very, very well, would expect $2 million for a library. Now, in fairness, in full disclosure, the Senate did, I believe, appropriate a couple hundred thousand dollars for Bro's papers to be organized and transported down to Louisiana and to be cataloged. And when they were given to LSU, there were 30 years worth of those papers, and it And so I think LSU may have gotten actually some federal funds to organize and catalog those papers, but it was certainly not $2 million.
Okay. We'll go back to the phones in just a moment. 297-5633 is your number. I got a couple of questions that have been imparted in a different way. Inkstershow@WRKF.org works. Governor Jindal, under his leadership, LSU is now 11th or 13th, depending on the poll, in the football rankings, 150th in the U.S. News and World Report rankings of colleges. But I'm looking, Bob. Under Jindal, LSU has won 77% of its games, and under Blanco, LSU won 83% of its football games. So there's some depletion here.
Well, Governor Blanco was sending in better plays.
Did she go to the games?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know she went. Kathleen Blanco went to more games in one season than Bobby Jindal has in his two terms.
Okay. Here's another question. Would Bob ever consider running for a statewide office?
No.
No?
No.
Would you pray about it?
Would I pray about it? I have thought of, early in my career, I thought about that, and then I decided that it wasn't something that I wanted to do.
And it's very difficult for a guy with your politics to win now.
Oh, besides that, even if I wanted to run for political office, I've got quite a record out there of what I've written that probably would be used against me.
Well, Ralph McAllister learned that, as did Quinn Hillier. When you write newspaper columns, you're giving ammunition every week to any political opponent.
Well, one of my dearest friends is Stan Tyner, who's the editor of the Shreveport Journal. I was his political writer, and he ran for Congress, and the same thing happened.
John in Lafayette. John, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. As far as the cuts to higher education, the Legislative Fiscal Office, I believe if you would check with them, they would tell you that the cuts have actually, under Jindal, been over 60% over the last 6 years. And it's been the highest percentage-wise in the whole United States. And what makes it really, really bad is that Governor Jindal did promise, when he ran successfully for governor, that he would make higher education a priority. And he talked about how LSU should be funded so they could compete with the other great research universities in the country. So it really makes his trail even worse. My question is, what does Mr. Mann think of the new LSU president?
King Alexander, I think, I was not a big fan of the way that he was hired. And I told him this personally, that I thought that he was done a very big disfavor, put at a great disadvantage with the faculty and the students and the community at large by the way, the secretive, illegal way that I think he was hired. But I've been around him a lot in the last couple of months, and so far I'm very impressed with his leadership and his willingness to speak out and defend this university. We'll see over the long term if he stays as strong in that stance. Other chancellors and presidents have been beaten down pretty hard by the fourth floor, by the governor and others. In fact, gag orders put on them and told they can't speak out. It'll be interesting to see if President Alexander is able to continue to defend this university in the ways that he has so far. But so far, I'm very pleased with him.
He's defended the selection process.
He has. He's defended the selection process.
Said he would not have applied.
Yeah.
If he had not been given confidentiality.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to changing the selection process. I think that that it could be modified in a way that would allow people like King Alexander to still apply and in some sort of process. It would not be public every time somebody submits a resume, but once the candidates are whittled down to four or five finalists, then they become public. That's what Nichols State recently did. That's what a lot of schools do. When you submit your resume, it doesn't go on a website, but once you're a finalist, then you have to decide, you want to remain a candidate because your name's about to be disclosed to the public.
And remember, Mark Emmert was a finalist, and he was head of the University of Connecticut when he applied to become chancellor of LSU. Didn't seem to bother him too much.
No, there's a lot of universities who have open processes, and they hire good people.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Bob Mann.
Yes. Does it seem to you that what Jindal's been doing is writing these puff pieces with the expectation that it gets picked up by the Wall Street Journal or other right-wing pundits the national exposure.
Oh yeah, he's been very aggressive at writing these op-eds in all kinds of places, the Picayune where I write, and national publications around the country. He's clearly trying to raise his profile and stand out as a very fierce opponent of Barack Obama and the Obama administration and Democrats in general.
What do you think of his quality of writing?
You know, it's very interesting. I actually, in my classes, I use some of his writing on his website as examples of the worst kind of writing. I think his press releases are abysmal. I don't know who writes press releases for mm-hmm. him, but that person was not educated at the Manship School.
But putting on your big boy pants and
I think the op-eds, you know, I'm not a big fan of what he writes, but I think they're much better written than anything that's on his website, which tells me that he's got a political consultant or someone else who doesn't work for him on the fourth floor writing that stuff. Because go to his website and read the abysmal quality of the press releases that they put up on that website every day, and then read those op-eds, and you can tell they're written by two different people.
Did you read his book?
Yes, I did. I did read his book. In fact, I refer to that book all the time. There's a lot in that book. If you want to read that book and then compare it to the way he's governed, it makes for very interesting and entertaining
leadership
reading.
Leadership and Crisis. You're smiling. You've written 9 books. Would you be proud to have your name on that book?
As an editor? As an
editor?
No, but I mean it's a well-written book. I have no problems with I think all the punctuation and grammar
it's fine.
Is pretty good, so.
But what about the meat?
Well, I think that Jindal in that book sets up a standard that he has not met. He talks about his transparency, for example. He writes a lot about transparency and other ethical standards that he has clearly not met. And so I use that book as a way to sort of remind myself to what the guy said and what he's done. Right. And they're two different things.
Okay, I'm gonna few more questions here. Fifth District, who do you think will win, McAllister or Reiser?
Wow, I have no idea. I really would like to be able to get up there and nose around
That's
a little bit
your
and
old
find
stomping
out.
Grounds. Landrieu next year. I think the election is exactly a year away.
Yeah,
it's now leaning Democratic, according to Charlie Cook and others, mm-hmm. but leaning very tenuously Democratic.
A lot of it is going to depend on what people are saying about Obamacare 6 months, 9 months from now, and also how much opposition Bill Cassidy gets from the right. And he hasn't completely tapped down all the opposition that might come from his own party.
RC writes, given Bobby's demonstrated intolerance for opposition and, he writes, vindictive nature, isn't your guest afraid of retaliation for his truth-telling? Please do not use my name for the same reasons. Thank you, RC.
Well, no, and we talked about that earlier. And so when people pat me on the back and tell me how brave I am, I do remind them that I have tenure, and I have the ability to speak out in ways that a lot of people on the LSU campus and on other campuses don't, who don't have tenure or staff who could be fired at will. And so I'm able to say things that other people cannot.
Well, we're glad you're saying them here, and Bob Mann is an opinionated fella. Lastly, is your opposition to Jindal, is it because of ideology, or is it what is it that gets to you the most?
Well, I think he's not governing in the best interest of Louisiana. He's used his platform as governor to run for president for almost six years now. That's what offends me the most, is that he doesn't care about voters of Louisiana as much as he cares about Republican primary voters.
Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined now by Sam Friedman. His book is Breaking the Line. We talked with him about his fine work regarding the legendary Eddie Robinson, head coach at Grambling State University, and James Shaq Harris, the quarterback who broke the color barrier in the NFL. And Grambling has more Pro Football Hall of Famers than any school in Louisiana, including LSU, 4 of them. But yet, Grambling State University's football program has hit hard times. The players boycotted, did not show up for a game, did not get on the bus to go to Jackson State a few weeks ago. Dennis Dirt Winston has been installed as the coach at Grambling. But the troubles that were evident a few weeks ago have not been erased with one big move, if that is a big move. Sam Friedman, how do you view the goings-on at Grambling right now?
Well, I think, Tim, first of all, thanks for having me back very much. I think there are two ways of looking at it. I mean, there's one piece which is was clearly the tense relationship between the president there, Frank Pogue, and the now deposed head football coach, Doug Williams, and I sort of want to move that off into one place, one corner. And then I think there's a whole broader issue here, which I think the football players did something valiant about, which was they used the attention that football gets there to draw attention to what's been years of very severe budget cuts inflicted on Grambling by the state, and then worsened by the fact that the state turned down stimulus money when it was available, money that many states with state universities took. And when the things the players were pointing to, the conditions in the weight room, the necessity to take these, you know, epic bus trips to away games that would consume, you know, basically 3 days of game time and travel time, take them away from, you know, campus and classes for such a long period, and, you know, the lack of money even for basic training cable things like, you know, Gatorade and Muscle Milk. That was the athletic department's experience of budget cuts, or some of the athletic department's experience of budget cuts that have afflicted the university as a whole. If anything, I think the cuts hit the athletic department later than other parts of the university. And one thing I'll say in President Pogue's defense is that 2 or 3 years ago, when he was trying to ring the alarm about what this was going to mean in terms of layoffs of academic staff and curtailing entire degree-granting programs, it got very little coverage. No one listened when people were making the case on academic grounds, and when the football players boycotted, this blew up instantly into a national story. I mean, a week ago, the New York Times had an editorial about this. So I think in that respect, the players have done something exceptional. And there's even an interesting historical parallel here, which actually I write about in Breaking the Line, which is that in the 67 football season, a group of student activists at Grambling, led by Willie Zanders, who's still a very prominent attorney in the area working on behalf of the displaced New Orleans public school teachers and principals, that group of students used homecoming week as an opportunity to draw attention to, you know, the terrible racial disparities in school and higher ed funding at that time. So I see the players now as sort of the heirs to that tradition. And, you know, as I've written, because I wrote something about this for ESPN.com, no matter what Grambling's record is on the field this season, and it's obviously not going to be a good one, even if they win out, it's a championship season in terms of these players taking a stand on something truly, truly important.
Well, Grambling's facilities have never been at the top echelon of college football. Eddie Robinson certainly didn't have the resources that Charlie McClendon did at LSU or Bear Bryant did at Alabama, and yet the players were loyal to him and would never refuse to get on the bus and go to a game. A moment ago, it sounded to me like, Sam, you're saying these players actually did a good thing by doing this.
Well, I think they did a very good thing in terms of calling national attention to these funding issues. You're right that the facilities that Eddie Robinson had were, you know, very poor compared to what Louisiana Tech, much less LSU, had at that time. But he was a coach who had tremendous loyalty among his players and earned it. And let's remember that in spite of these facilities and everything else, these players were tremendously loyal to Doug Williams. And I think it says something about his ability to connect to players that these players remained loyal to him, A, during a long losing streak, B, when Doug's son, DJ, was the starting quarterback. Those are two elements that, if these players weren't really devoted to a coach, could, you know, cause a lot of dissent. You get grumbling naturally enough when the team is losing. And if the team is losing and the coach's son is the quarterback, it's sort of inviting even more dissent. None of that happened. Oh, so I think it says something about his leadership on the team. It also, you know, going back to Eddie Robinson, said something about Coach Rob. The other thing, though, let's, you know, be clear, Grambling had extraordinary teams over decades under Coach Robinson, but But for most of those years, many of them, African-American players couldn't go to LSU, couldn't go to Louisiana Tech, couldn't go to Texas or Alabama or any of the other schools that, you know, that are recruiting them very avidly now.
Well, we thank you for a brief discussion about this today, Sam, and maybe down the line we can talk about it further, because there are issues that are still permeating, and it will be interesting to see how the Bayou Classic goes later this month. But
I'd be glad to come back and talk anytime.
The book is Breaking the Line, about the 1967 season, and it is quite a book about the history of Grambling football. Thank you, Sam Friedman.
Thanks so much, Jim. Have a great weekend.
You too. And we're joined now by Rebecca Hamilton, or JC tells me we will be in just a moment. At least that's the plan. There we go. Rebecca Hamilton, the state librarian, and she is a busy bee because tomorrow the Louisiana Book Festival will be taking place right here in our midst in Baton Rouge. And good morning to you, Rebecca.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And you've got a list of luminaries from the literary world who will be on hand. I do want to note that the great Ernest Gaines will be in the House Chamber tomorrow at 3 o'clock, a conversation with Ernest Gaines. And this is the man who gave us A Lesson Before Dying and the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and many other classics. And he is among a full list of outstanding writers, but it's hard to top Ernest James Gaines.
It is. We love him, and he is a great friend of the festival. And tomorrow it will be a full day from 10 to 5, all day downtown at the State Library, the State Capitol, and the State Museum. So if you come to the book festival, you will be busy all day. We have, kicking it off at 10 o'clock, we've got the Louisiana Writer Award going to Christine Wiltz, Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden, who is the honorary chairman of the festival and the reason we're having the festival. He'll be giving her that award. And then we have Wally Lamb, Shirley Ann Grau, Duck Commander, Alan Robertson. We had to have a Duck Commander come. Lots of food and music and lots of things for teens, Jim, and young people. We've got a huge children's pavilion that grows every year, so it's really a family event. People come out with the whole family.
Who are some of the other writers that we obviously won't be able to see and hear them all, but in addition to Ernest Gaines, you've got some others who are known not only in Louisiana but around the country and across the globe.
We do. We've, like I mentioned, Shirley Ann Grau is one of them, Wally Lamb. We've got Rick Bragg, who's today teaching one of our word shops. You know, the Friday before the festival, we have word shops with some of our famous writers teaching classes on different types of writing styles. If you want to see a full list of all of the authors, all of the programs, you can go to www.louisianabookfestival.org for an alphabetical listing of everybody. It's over 200 authors.
Over 200, and that's a lot of authors in a short period of time. I even see that the Agriculture Commissioner, Mike Strain, is going to be featured. And no matter what your taste, you could probably find somebody to satisfy it among the 200 authors.
Absolutely. And we brought back the cooking demonstration tent as well. We've got just really, you know, we always say we have an embarrassment of riches because people, the only complaint, if you can even call it that, is people saying there's so much to do, I can't see everything that I want to see because there's just so much going on.
297-5633, if you'd like to join us in our remaining moments. If you have a question, maybe you're interested in whether a particular author will be on hand. I do have a question online asking if General Russell Honoré will be with you tomorrow, with us, and I think the answer is yes.
Yes. He is a great friend of the festival.
He will be there. Another question. A listener asked if the Angela Davis who is on hand, that's not the activist, is it?
It's a local storyteller. As part of our large children's pavilion, we hire storytellers to come and give performances for our young people. So, no, I think her full name is Angela Davis, the Yarn Spinner.
Okay. But
she's a storyteller.
But there are some activists who will be there. Believe me, it is quite a list, and I'm looking over the list right now. And the problem when you start naming a few people is that inevitably some folks are left off, but
that's exactly
correct. Whether it's fiction, nonfiction, you name it, writers will be on hand to to satisfy your tastes.
And, you know, that's what we're kind of known for, that intimate environment where you can go see your favorite author, ask a question during their program, go afterwards to Barnes & Noble tent, purchase their book, get it signed. So we like that intimate atmosphere that we create, as opposed to going to another book festival where maybe you're in an auditorium with 100 other people or 500 other people.
Yeah. And I was asked about the poet laureate, Ava Heyman. She'll be there.
She will be there. And several of our former poet laureates, I think Daryl Bork will be there. So we have a huge lineup.
Yes,
I'm
indeed.
Looking at the list now. Jack Bedell, who we all love. We've got some local flavor, local music. Ben Bell and the Stardust Boys. And Circa Amore, which is a young group from Baton Rouge. Rick Kelly is doing our outreach to the children in the schools this week. So we've really, and Ernest Gaines, I just think everybody should come out to see Ernest Gaines. If you've not met him or gone to one of his programs, he's just amazing.
3 o'clock tomorrow in the House Chamber is Ernest Gaines. This festival, it started and then it stopped and then it restarted. It's primarily the work of the Lieutenant Governor who made this come back.
Correct. We've been around since 2002. We've only canceled twice, once in 2005 after our terrible storms, and then again in 2010 when we had some reduced staffing and reduced budget. And one of the first things Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden said to me is, I want this festival back. And, you know, as we all know, I don't know if anybody that knows more about Louisiana writing and Louisiana authors than he does. He's a fantastic speaker, and he loves to read. He loves books. So he completely gets what we're trying to do with this festival. And so we give him really all of the credit.
Rod Dreher, who was on this show not so long ago, he will be there tomorrow.
Yes.
Bob Mann mentioned Jinx Coleman-Broussard, who's at the Manship School. The former dean, Jack Hamilton, will be featured among the writers tomorrow. And some folks familiar to WRKF, Poppy Tooker, Marianne Sternberg, they're featured as well. Michael Sartiski of the Endowment for the Humanities, he will be one of the 200. And Zachary Richard, who will be performing with Johnny Rivers tomorrow night at Baton Rouge High. He's among the writers, isn't he?
He is. He's on our list.
Well, so you do have some from just about every walk of life. And then you got Bob Mann, who is not officially one of the writers listed, but he will be introducing Jinx Broussard. So,
Bob Mann is the chair of our foundation, which helps raise those private dollars for us to use towards the festival.
And those are important, aren't they?
They are very important. We live by them. If it weren't for the volunteers and the donations of people that love the festival and believe in it, it would be hard to have it.
All right, here's a question from a listener. Is Louis Gossett Jr., is he one of the writers?
He is. He's actually, he did write a book, An Actor and a Gentleman, but he is here to participate in the 12 Years a Slave program. He narrated the audiobook for that film. And so for that book, and so he will be joining us. We're very excited about that.
One of the great actors of this time.
He is, and we've been chuckling because anybody younger than, say, 35 tends to not remember who he is. And we've all been so excited about him coming and think it's funny that, you know, there's a definite age where you draw the line between generations and who remembers who.
Well, Louis Gossett Jr., Ernest Gaines, and a collection of others. I even see Tom Aswell, the guy who stirs it up politically, Louisiana Voice. He's there as well.
Yes, John Biganay, who won our Louisiana Writer Award last year.
I bet you're already preparing for next year.
Oh, we do. My poor little staff collapsed the day after the festival, and then around December, January, we pick it right back up again because we don't want to leave anybody out. You know, anybody that wants to come and that we have the ability to bring here, we try to do it. So it is definitely a year-round event that we plan.
Well, it's something that comes to fruition tomorrow, culminates with quite a spectacle in downtown Baton Rouge, and literally thousands of people in the past years have shown up for this.
Yes.
Do you have any projection as to what you would like to see tomorrow?
Well, our record is 25,000, and so that's what we're trying to beat.
25,000.
Yes.
So we're talking about one quarter of the number of people who come to an LSU football game on Saturdays. So this is a chance for people who like books and writers and appreciate their works to show their support.
And the person we know that's coming the farthest is coming from Scotland to attend.
Who is that?
I don't recall her name. She's just a patron that wants to attend the book festival.
Okay, I had another question. O'Neill Isaac? Is he?
He may be, let me look at my list. He may be at storytelling kit. Yes, he's probably going to be doing, he's one of our, you know, local storytellers. He's going to be in the storytelling tent from 2:45 to 3:15.
Right before Ernest Gaines, 3 o'clock in the House chamber. Thank you, Rebecca, and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you.
Rebecca Hamilton, state librarian. And hats off to those who made the return of the book festival come about. For J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Have a great weekend. We'll be back Monday. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.